Thank you. I have no relationships to disclose. Can you hear us? Can you hear me? Is this better? Okay. All right. Just let me know if my voice doesn't carry. All right, so I'll give you a little bit of an outline of my presentation. I'll give you a brief background and an overview of the process that we use for nutrition advocacy, and some examples from the countries where we've done this work most recently, in Bangladesh, Uganda, and Ghana, and end with some lessons learned that we feel we can carry forward and based on our experience. So just a little background. In most developing countries, I'm sure you're all aware, malnutrition is still widely prevalent, and for the most part, investment in nutrition at the national level particularly is quite low, and that's always been a particular challenge. So, and one of the things that has resulted as a result of less investment in nutrition is that the rate of malnutrition or the rate of reduction over time has been slow and has been slowing in some of the countries where prevalence is greatest. So if you think of countries like India and Bangladesh, you could see that the rate of change or the rate of improvement is very stagnant and is slowing to a near halt. So to improve both investment and visibility for nutrition, we've undertaken a lot of work in advocacy, and the goal is really to promote governance and accountability for nutrition, increase resource allocation, strengthen implementation of services, as well as expand coverage of services. So what we've done is to use data, projections, and estimates to help make the case for greater investment in nutrition because of the benefits of improved nutrition, and also try to bring more information and evidence on what the cost of nutrition is in a particular country setting. So just an overview of what we've used for nutrition advocacy. I'll go over a little bit of what is Profiles. Profiles is a spreadsheet or a tool that we've used to help generate estimates on the benefits of improved nutrition. I'll talk a little bit about nutrition costing, what we are using for nutrition advocacy, and how those particular tools of Profiles and nutrition costing have been used for the nutrition advocacy work we're doing. So Profiles. Profiles is a tool, it's an evidence-based advocacy tool that was created in the early 90s by AED, now FHI 360, and it really does take into account a lot of the global metadata for different countries for which we know there are robust relationships, like young child malnutrition or rates of stunting and underweight and its relationship to child mortality, for example. So we know that when children are malnourished, they're at greater risk of dying. Those types of relationships help us create estimates to advocate for greater investment in nutrition. So the tool itself looks at a series of different nutrition indicators and gives us some estimates for each of those in terms of what the improvement would be if we reduced the prevalence of malnutrition in those countries. It's a tool for us to engage with government and high-level stakeholders in a collaborative setting for an advocacy process. It helps us identify and prioritize the actions that are needed to reduce malnutrition. When we think about nutrition costing, what we've done more recently is to try to come up with models in-country to estimate the cost of implementing a comprehensive program for nutrition and specified or specific time period. And as a part of a collaborative stakeholder-driven exercise, we try to arrive at what's the structure of a nutrition program, what kinds of components would be there, what kind of implementation would be there, including the interventions and the activities, what is the management structure, what is the approach to service provision, what would the actual unit cost be for those particular services. So the nutrition advocacy we're doing is not different than most other advocacy efforts. It's a planned process to ignite social change, and we're using it in favor of nutrition, trying to get greater visibility and effort and investment in nutrition. It's a way for us to promote accountability and strengthen governance, and it's largely defined by the country context at that point in time. So it can support a country at any stage in its own development, wherever they are in terms of commitment for nutrition, whether it's low or high, whether they have interest in nutrition but not necessarily implementation of services at scale. Whichever point they are, we can come in and sort of undertake nutrition advocacy activities to support them and increase investment and resource allocation for nutrition to improve to reduce the rates of malnutrition in that country. We've used profiles on nutrition costing in this particular setting, and it's a cornerstone of what we're using for our nutrition advocacy efforts. So while there's an effort to do a planned communication effort as a part of our advocacy process, we're using the results that come from profiles and the costing models to really help inform and fill out and tell a better story on why people should engage, increase the visibility, and make the case for investment in nutrition. So just on profiles, these are the relationships that profiles really addresses, and this is based on data, global data that we have from different studies in different countries. So if we think of iron deficiency anemia, we know that it reduces maternal mortality and perinatal mortality. So if we were to address anemia, that would be one outcome. If we think about low birth weight, it's related to infant mortality. If we think about vitamin A deficiency, it's linked to child mortality. Iodine deficiency, there's permanent disabilities in children. If we think about stunting, underweight, and wasting, you think of child mortality. There's also the relationship between stunting, low birth weight, and iron deficiency in particular, and iodine on economic productivity. So what this model basically does is that it can give you estimates that if you did nothing at all from today going forward for the next 5 or 10 years, you would potentially see what we call the status quo, that malnutrition rates might continue to increase simply because of increasing population, and therefore child mortality rates would likely edge up because of increasing population, but no additional investment in nutrition efforts. So that's one example. It also then tells you that if we're working with a group, we try to come up with what are the targets. By how much do you envision that you would like to reduce rates of malnutrition? So if malnutrition is at 50% today, we work with the stakeholders to arrive at what they think is the best possible reduction in their country context. And if they say, well, we envision a world where malnutrition is only 15%, or it's a country free of malnutrition altogether. Whatever they set as the target is what we use in the model, and it's based on that that we're able to estimate the actual change over time in terms of reductions in the rate of malnutrition. So that's really what we're trying to do. So it doesn't actually talk about the specific interventions. It's assuming that if those interventions were implemented at scale and they reached those stated targets, then you would see a reduction in the rate of malnutrition. And you would see, therefore, benefit in reduced child mortality and improvement in terms of economic productivity. So that's really what Profiles does. Here's an example of the timeline that we've taken in countries when we start the process. We often start with working with a core group in country that's very committed, members of government who could be from the Ministry of Health, for example, or non-government as well, and just form a core group to get the process started. We then will go through a process where we work with multiple stakeholders in country to start talking about at the first meeting at least, targets, goals, vision for reduction, and then over time come up with their preliminary results. And as we have preliminary results, also go through a process to plan and do a communication and advocacy strategy with those stakeholders. What types of messages do we want to communicate? Which audiences do we want to select? Who do we want to reach out to with this information? And then the final stages as time goes by is to prepare the materials, but also consistently meet with these different audience segments. They can include parliamentarians, they can be media, they can be policymakers in government, they can be other civil society stakeholders. It just depends on those that have been selected. So to give you some examples, the countries where we've done this work, including Uganda, Ghana, and Bangladesh, the rates of malnutrition are high in all three of those countries. Stunting is in the range of 38%, 43%, sometimes lower, sometimes higher. And acute malnutrition is also very high in most of these countries as well. So here's an example of the results that we get. And in Uganda, for example, the team decided that the window or the period of time was from 2006 to 2015. So in that window, if they assumed that they could eliminate malnutrition, here's what the benefit would be. So if you eliminated stunting, you would save more than 72,000 lives. If you eliminated wasting, you'd save more than 67,000 lives. And that is the case for Ghana and Bangladesh. For countries like Bangladesh, where population is extremely high to begin with, the gains are that much greater because the population is high to start with. And the expectation is that if you invested in nutrition, these are the benefits you'd see in terms of child mortality. If you think about the other types of nutrition indicators like iron deficiency anemia, you would avert maternal deaths, perinatal deaths. If you think about low birth weight, you'd avert infant deaths, as well as child deaths related to vitamin A deficiency and iodine deficiency, for example, would avert permanent disability and mental retardation, which are known to be a result of iodine deficiency. So this is an example of what the gains would be if we reduced those rates of malnutrition. This is an example from economic productivity gains, the amount that a country would gain in terms of GDP growth in dollar amounts. It's not necessarily to the government, but it's the whole economy, what they would gain as a result of reducing micronutrient and chronic malnutrition. We in Bangladesh also had the chance to do the costing work where we were able to estimate what would it cost to provide nutrition services at scale in the country. And this was used as a part of our advocacy process to help increase investment and resource allocation for nutrition, where it was pretty low to begin with, there were no services to begin with, and spur more action. So in the three countries, here are some examples of the results. So in Uganda, we were able to disseminate the results from profiles. We were able to set up advocacy, develop advocacy materials that were focused on these nutrition outcomes, as well as do some work with at the district level and sort of had a task force to work on this. And that resulted in the adoption and development of a Uganda Nutrition Action Plan, which is something that people have been working towards for a long time but hadn't been adopted and has now been signed by the Office of the has been signed by the President and is being operationalized by the Office of the Prime Minister. We've also been able to work with policymakers on the Food and Nutrition Bill that's being considered, and also are developing a budgeting tool for districts to allocate resources for nutrition. In Ghana, we've done a similar process where we've actually worked with the government, the Ghana Health Service, to be able to develop advocacy materials and work with a task force, and also working with media to increase coverage of nutrition issues in the media and to make sure that it's both accurate and more in-depth reporting, as well as more coordinated messages, coordinated approaches from within the government. And provided the data that we have has contributed a lot to the national nutrition and food policy. In Bangladesh, we've been able to use this as well to raise visibility and commitment for nutrition, and also provided them with the information they need to increase resource allocation in terms of funding for their next 5 years to increase it toward for nutrition. We've also been working with parliamentarians and promoting interministerial coordination so that there can be more cross-sectoral efforts across government. So some lessons learned. We found that advocacy of this type is helpful in a context where the prevalence of malnutrition is high. There are many different types of malnutrition, where investment and commitment, governance and accountability for nutrition is low, and where nutrition services in general are also fragmented and not very holistic. And that if we're using advocacy processes for nutrition, they need to be based on a good understanding of the country context at the time. It's useful for it to be a very systematic and a planned and deliberate process. It has to be owned at the country level by the stakeholders in country, and it has to involve multiple stakeholders, both government and non-government, including civil society. To be multi-sectoral and to get buy-in from multiple stakeholders to raise the visibility and commitment for nutrition, and also target certain key audiences like parliamentarians and others who might be very influential to getting laws adopted and to getting policies in place. The tools that we've used, profiles and nutrition costing, were really helpful for insight to action. They really help us build consensus and get people to agree on what's needed for nutrition and speak about it with one voice rather than multiple different different perspectives, and try to promote accountability and goal setting for what's needed for nutrition in terms of investing in nutrition across the life cycle so that there's a continuum of care from prevention to treatment in terms of providing the services. And I'll stop there.
Challenges and barriers to getting the investment in nutrition programs, because
I think one of the challenges is the fact that most policymakers are not aware of these relationships, and they don't realize the extent to which it has an implication for child mortality. What you and I know, for example, isn't well known by lots of other people, and so that's one of the issues. They don't necessarily know all of these relationships and its implication for child mortality, and they certainly don't know its implication for economic productivity, for example. But once you start to engage them in that way, so the implication for education outcomes, for economic productivity, they start to realize that there's a much bigger reason that they have to really invest in it. But that has to be unpacked for them a little bit more. For the most part, the advocacy work stays at a higher level because it works with multiple stakeholders at the national level often. It depends. If the country has sort of more district-level funding, for example, and has a decentralized budget, then there's more opportunity for us to get to the district level. That said, I think that this type of an advocacy strategy, as with many others, it really does fit within the broader social and behavior change communication aspect. So it is something that we take into consideration. The challenge with, say, infant feeding is that there isn't enough global data from different countries where we can show sort of odds ratios and risk ratios to be able to model it in a particular way to show these results. So the anthropometry and these types of data are much more useful to be able to show those relationships. They've existed for much longer. We have much more data, so we can model across them. But when we prepare materials, for example, some of what we do is to address infant feeding and the other aspects that are really underlying issues as to why there are such high rates of stunting in a particular country. It is, however, separate than a lot of the social and behavior change activities that you might do at a community level, which is at a lower level in communities working with them. So it's a little bit separate, but they all have to happen in tandem for you to see the changes that you want. I think that the thing is that in most countries, you have experts in nutrition who really know that there is a widespread problem. It's not that the experts aren't there. It's just that they've never been able to come together in any kind of a unified way to really make the case for greater investment. And Uganda is a great example of that. I mean, Uganda, the government really feels that they're very food secure, that they have been the breadbasket of Africa, they've always had enough food. So even talking to them about food security has always been a challenge. It's very challenging because they've always felt they've had enough, and so they're not recognizing that still there are high rates of malnutrition, that just having enough food and food availability in the country doesn't mean you're not going to have malnutrition, because not everybody can afford that food and can buy that food. So it certainly does take a coalition of people coming together to really make the case. So it's a long process. It's not something that can happen overnight. So I think the barriers, you have to chip away at them somewhat, and you have to work at them. But I think having the data to show what the benefits can be helps convert a lot of people and recognize that there is a lot of value in making this investment. That if you didn't make this investment, if you think about the MDGs, for example, if you don't invest in nutrition, you can't achieve several of the MDGs. It's not going to happen. You're going to reach a plateau on many of the ones on infectious disease or others because you have to have good nutrition to make those happen. So that's part of the issue. So it's always challenging, but I think that this process allows you to bring people together, and that enables them to think about it in a more unified way and make the case for using the data, make the case for greater investment. So it's a process.
Malnutrition in terms of having plenty of food, but are you also, or is it possible that you're looking at it from the standpoint of the nutritional content of the food in those countries? Because some of these countries, their food is probably high in starch and
right.
No protein, so you guys also.
Yeah. I mean, most of the time when we're looking at you know, nutrition in this particular case, when you're making the case and you're looking at stunting and wasting, these are like the end outcomes of having had years of poor nutrition, for example. This is the outcome of kids not getting a very diverse diet, for example. So this particular, the data that we end up with doesn't really speak specifically to diet diversity and doesn't speak specifically to food security. But what's important is that when you pair that with what the existing problems are, you have to be able to unpack it and say that a large part of the reason you have malnutrition and the rates that you have is because you don't have enough diet diversity in the country. But a large reason why they continue to have those challenges is purchasing power. They really can't afford the variety of foods that they need to be able to have in their household to be able to address the diet diversity issue. So that continues to be a challenge. So having enough food doesn't necessarily get you where you want to be. And there's a lot of changes in food prices. So some of that are the types of things you can address in the materials that you prepare. And so the results can be used in that direction as you need to.
So I give another thank you to Kavita for her So if anyone has a question for any of the four, please let us know, and if you can remember whose name is whose, to direct it to that. Any questions? Otherwise, okay.
So the young lady over here mentioned something in regards to Malawi and the growing season, which I thought was a really interesting point that she hit on, and stressors that occur during different times of the year. So when crops are in the process of growing and people are hungry, if you ask some of the similar questions, you know, the same questions during those high stress times, would you maybe get a different answer, you know, because sometimes when people aren't in the moment, maybe they don't recognize that problem, or they think they dismiss it, you know, 12 months later or something like that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. Very interesting question, and I think it's a question that will probably get some feedback, because we're in the process of looking at qualitative data,
okay,
and it's going to help us feed into some of the results. So we're in the process of analyzing our data, and we probably be able to pick that up. But I am from Africa, and I can tell you that I'm not very sure if seasonality really plays into some of the outcomes. I don't think so, but, you know, we'll let the data speak for itself. Yeah. I don't know if Lauren or Lance has anything else to say. Yeah.
Any other questions from the audience? So I had a question for Sarah, actually. You brought up this point about most Americans being in favor of development and foreign aid funding, which I think is great. So Sarah brought up the point around most Americans being in support of development funding, which I think is great, and she brought up this whole concept of people wanting a smaller percentage of our budget being dedicated to aid, since they didn't actually know what percentage was allocated for it. My question is, do you think we're going to run into problems if, you know, people start understanding that the amount of money we're spending is actually such a small percentage? I'm not quite sure how to ask my question, but I think there's going to be a dissonance when people find out that, you know, the amount is actually a very small percentage, because I feel like not a lot of people are responding to the percentage of money that's spent. They're just responding to the perceived amount that's being spent. So what do you think could be the effects of saying, oh, actually all of this money is like this really tiny amount. You want 10%? Great, that's 10 times more than what we're already spending. I think that's a question.
That's a great question. And I mean, generally, the American public just does not have any idea what foreign aid does. They don't understand it. And so from Oxfam's point of view, what we try to do is we try to tell stories. So, you know, the data out there is you can say, you know, 1 in 8 people around the world is hungry. That's fine. But if you tell the story of a mom in Malawi who is hungry, people understand what foreign aid can do. And so for us, it's about telling stories. But, I mean, as a development community, we've talked about, can we do some kind of big, you know, public awareness campaign around 1%? And it's just really hard. It's just really hard to educate Americans on those numbers. And at this point, we are not looking for 10% at all. We are really just looking, we're advocating for just steady funding, and not for funding to be significantly cut. So I don't know if that really didn't answer the question, but...
Any other questions? All right. Well, I want to thank our panelists. I want to thank all of you for coming, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your conference. Thanks.